Hi, this is Dan Kilbride. I am the chair of the history department at John Carroll University outside of Cleveland, Ohio. I'm also the host of New Books in American Studies. That means that from time to time, we find an author of an interesting book on American history. It's usually American history on this show, but it could be literature, science, public health, urban studies, anything and everything to do with the United States. And today we are joined by Nathaniel Millett. He's an associate professor of history at St. Louis University, and we're here to discuss his book, The Maroons of Prospect Bluff and Their Quest for Freedom in the Atlantic World. This book's been published by the University Press of Florida, or maybe it's called the University of Florida Press by now, in 2013. So Nathaniel Millett, welcome to New Books in American Studies.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
No, it's our pleasure. This book is a really timely one because even though our listeners might not be aware of it, we are in the midst of the 200th anniversary of the War of 1812. So we're right in the middle of that. It's an important war in American history, and it's a war that is front and center in this book. So that's something that our readers could learn a lot about here. There's also a lot of other really interesting stuff, especially the early history of Florida, which this book deals with, the history of what are called maroon communities, something that's one of the most interesting subjects about the history of slavery, and what is really apropos in historical studies now, which is the history of the Atlantic world. So this book intersects a lot of very hot and topical areas in historical scholarship today. So Nathaniel, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your path to this book?
Right. As you said, I'm an associate professor at St. Louis University. This is my first book, and this book is a case study which very much reflects my interest in Atlantic history, the borderlands, situating North American history in a comparative perspective, the War of 1812, I suppose, to a degree as well. But like I said, this is a micro-history even, or a case study of a maroon community, which I'm sure that we'll discuss, which I think pokes at very, very big ideas in both the history of North America, the Western Hemisphere, and the broader Atlantic world during the colonial period and Age of Revolution.
One thing that our readers might not know that much, or our listeners might not know that much about, is the early history of Florida. Florida probably enters the historical consciousness of most Americans sometime around the 1940s or 1950s with the advent of air conditioning and Disney World. So, you know, in terms of its intersection with early American history, can you just locate Florida for us in the era of the Atlantic revolutions?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And I think you're entirely right. Most Americans, again, don't start to think about Florida until they start to think about the citrus industry and tourism and Disney World and things like that. But Florida has, by North American standards, an ancient history of European, African, and indigenous contact, and actually the oldest history of that, beginning in 1513. So it's the 500th anniversary. And Europeans and Africans arrived in Florida just around Easter of 1513. Florida, for the vast majority of the next 300 years, was a Spanish colony, with the exception of what's called the British period from 1764 to the end of the American Revolution, 1783. And it existed very much on the periphery of Spain's Atlantic Empire. And what happened in Florida is you got this society which is very much different from French and English North America, where it was underpopulated by Europeans, and accordingly they had to go to great lengths to work with Africans and Native Americans to make sure that Anglo-America did not acquire Florida. As a result, you get this really interesting, fluid and dynamic society where, in particular, racial relations are much more fluid. Spanish Florida drives Anglo-America, the English colonies, and then the young United States nuts because they're convinced that this undermines plantation slavery, it undermines their relations with the Native Americans, and that Florida is basically a security threat to the Anglo colonies and then the young United States. Florida will become part of the United States in 1819 with a treaty which goes into effect in 1821. So Florida was a Spanish colony for infinitely longer than it's been part of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that this book deals with, which maybe requires a little bit of definition, is the concept of a Maroon community. Those who study Atlantic history know Maroon communities well, but in American history, they are less of a major subject. What is Maroon communities, and where do we find them in the Atlantic world?
Sure. Maroons are, I think, utterly fascinating, and that's what's at the core of this book, North America's largest Maroon community. And a Maroon community was something on the surface relatively deceptively simple, I'll say, and that is a community of former slaves and or their descendants who had abandoned slavery for themselves, usually fled into mountainous interiors or to swamplands, and lived usually in very inhospitable environments, and were usually kind of guerrilla entities, guerrilla and survivalist entities, which did everything possible to avoid re-enslavement. In virtually every other slave society in the Americas, in places like Brazil and Suriname, Jamaica, Cuba, there was a great tradition of Maroonage. There were thousands of escaped slaves, usually living in the interior. Some of these communities got to number into the thousands. The biggest example ever is a Maroon, which spanned most of the 1600s in Brazil, called Palmeiras, mm-hmm. which numbered about 10,000 inhabitants spread around a series of different villages. These Maroons had a couple of other hallmarks. Some of the biggest and most successful ones oftentimes signed treaties with the colonial governments. This happens in Jamaica and Suriname because colonial armies simply couldn't defeat them. And when they signed treaties, they tended to gain a version of legal status. But it came with things the Maroons had to give up. They usually had to agree to not accept new members, to police the island slaves. Frequently, these Maroon communities owned slaves and could be described as actually kind of pro-slavery entities. Maroon culture tended to be conservative or restorationist in that Maroons tended to hark back to Africa in how they thought about their culture and conceptualized their identity. But what is interesting is it was never a perfect reproduction of Africa because of the effects of time and different versions of Africa because of the diverse array of Maroon founders. It tended to be fictive and imagined, and some Maroons, the longest-lived ones, ended up developing ethnic identities where they came to think of themselves as a particular type of people. They developed languages, religions, and a lot of Maroons in Suriname and Jamaica continue to exist today. You can find them in the interior, and they have ethnic identity and separate legal statuses. And one last thing, historians have argued for a very long time that North America lacked the tradition of Maroonage.
Right.
Because they largely did, because of the different black to white ratios, because of the nature of plantation slavery. But there were Maroon communities, and the most formidable and largest was this community that I look at.
This is a book that is very much, maybe it's unfair to say it's driven by a particular person, but there's a figure in this book that is a major driver of the action in the book. It's a guy named Edward Nichols. I'm going to let you describe him, but I'll say that he's a foe of the United States, a dedicated foe, a principled foe of slavery, and a friend of African peoples. Who is this person?
That's exactly right. And I'm glad that you identified that he's front and center in the book. And that reflects, from what I can figure, looking at pretty much the extant documentary record, the realities of events as they unfolded in the Southeast. Nichols is an utterly fascinating character. He's a Royal Marine. He's in the British Navy. He is born in the middle 18th century in Coleraine in the north of Ireland, and he grows up in a deeply religious Ulster Protestant Calvinist household. And Nichols has an intense sense of the British Empire as an empire of liberalism, an inclusive empire. And Nichols tends to see things in very black and white terms. And I think at the core of Nichols' identity is his Northern Irish upbringing in a fundamentally English empire and the fact that he feels, I think, a bit insecure. And he compensates by tremendous energy and this idea of, again, this expansive British Empire, And one of the things that this makes him come to do is really revile slavery, as an affront to this British entity, and an institution which cannot be reconciled with his moralism and his, again, kind of extreme Aristotelian approach to everything. As a result, he comes up with this anti-slavery ideology, in which he, one, identifies slavery as completely evil, two, something which can be violently attacked and murder and war are okay to fight slavery, and three, one of the things that make one and two possible is his belief that Africans and their descendants are entirely equal to whites, and there's an extreme anti-racism, I suppose, embedded in his ideology.
Yeah.
And number four, I suppose, what makes this unique is that he acts on this, and he acts on this during the War of 1812, which is what I'm talking about in my book, and then most conspicuously later in his career, when between 1829 and 1834, he's the British governor, Fernando Poe. And Fernando Poe is an anti-slavery outpost off the coast of Africa in modern-day Equatorial Guinea, where his job is to oversee the British Navy intercepting illegal slavers and then reintroducing Africans to largely Sierra Leone. And then, after he retires, he becomes a very prominent, very famous anti-slavery advocate who does all the kind of dinner circuit in Britain and becomes a great friend of all the leading lights of anti-slavery activism.
Mm-hmm. Nichols certainly stands out in the sort of grand history of anti-slavery for somebody who was not only anti-slavery but anti-racist. Mm-hmm. This might seem counterintuitive to some people, but you know, in the history of the anti-slavery struggle, it was more common to be both racist and anti-slavery at the same time. But Nichols, maybe we'd say, had a more modern racial sensibility, that he saw the racial core of the justification of slavery. To what extent was Nichols able to transcend the overwhelming racist atmosphere of this time period and make a personal and empathetic connection to African peoples?
Well, it's remarkable, and you're exactly right that even the leading anti-slavery and abolitionist advocates were frequently what we would identify as deeply racist. They abhorred the institution, but it was frequently for self-serving reasons, and they didn't necessarily believe in black equality or the potential for assimilating former slaves, and they believed in colonization. They believed in all types of different things, which we would again identify as deeply racist. Not Nichols. Nichols fights and serves and is willing to die with people of color, both in Florida and in Africa. He works closely with them. He preaches his radical anti-slavery message directly to them. He sits down and converses with these things. And from what I can figure as well, is after he leaves Florida in 1815 and leaves this independent Maroon community, he keeps up a correspondence with the community, usually via proxies as well. So, I mean, he literally is his, I don't know, transatlantic pen pals with this Maroon community after he'd gone back to London and gotten married and begun what could be a potentially very middle class life. So his energy, I think, is unrelenting. And it's, again, this unique combination of radical ideology and action. He's there fighting and bleeding and living side by side over the course of decades with people of African descent.
You know, one of the major subjects of this book is the pressure and the tension between the revolutionary movements of the late 18th and early 19th century and slavery in the entire Atlantic world. So, you know, we want to need to remind people that, you know, when we say the revolutionary era, we're not just talking about the era of the American Revolution, but the revolutionary movements in the United States, in France, in Saint-Domingue, and in the Spanish-American world. How did these revolutionary movements create a crisis for the institution of slavery?
I think they absolutely do, and I think you really see it come to the fore in the Southeast. I think because you have so many multiple strands. You have the ideological contradictions, the glaring ideological contradictions of the American Revolution and all of the rhetoric of equality and all men are created equal with slavery and the rapid displacement of Native Americans. You have the crumbling Spanish Empire, who is reeling from the Napoleonic invasions and then from the Latin American Wars of Revolution. You have people who are eyewitnesses to the Haitian Revolution. But I think the most important thing is that you also have the westward and southward expansion of the American plantation complex onto very unstable grounds where Native Americans are, the Creeks and the Seminoles in particular, are still very, very powerful. And you have, I think, a deep insecurity amongst white Americans about the unsteady ground, I suppose, that slavery is moving into. And fears about slave resistance are at all-time highs. Fears about abolitionism and anti-slavery are at all-time highs. And this kind of unifying idea of fears about racial disorder, which is I use a lot in the book, are at all-time highs. And all these things come crashing to a head in Spanish Florida, and enter Nichols, enter the War of 1812 against the world's foremost power in a war which was pretty ideological. Certainly the rhetoric between the United States and Great Britain about which is the most liberal nation, which nation most fully represents human progress. And then you have an anti-slavery advocate right in the middle of all of this, arm and train and radicalize hundreds and hundreds of people of African descent. So I think you see that the multiple, economic, physical, geopolitical and intellectual contours of the Age of Revolution all crashing together in the Southeast.
One of the questions I frequently ask students in a variety of classes where we talk about slavery is I hate this word, but I'll use it anyway, the impact of the revolutionary era on slavery. Do you think that slavery emerges from the revolutionary era in, say, 1815, weaker or stronger than it went into it?
I think stronger, without a doubt. And I think, one, it emerges from the Constitutional Convention in a stronger position because the Constitution really doesn't attack it and empowers the South with the Three-Fifths Compromise. And I think the War of 1812 is utterly central in the history of American slavery. The Louisiana Purchase in 1803 is important, but I feel very much that it's the War of 1812 that allows Americans in the South to eventually acquire Spanish Florida, to pacify the native tribes, and to make that insecure ground, which I just referred to, much more secure. Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of white American Southerners' minds, the war secures the southern frontier for the expansion of slavery. So I think in no uncertain terms, slavery emerges much more importantly. And then if you look at the antebellum period, I mean, slavery with the Industrial Revolution in Great Britain will become of the utmost economic importance to the broader United States. And so much of this is paved in the early Republic, as the Southeast is prepared and to become the premier portion of the American slave society.
Right. There's an interesting counterpoint to the figure of Edward Nichols in this book, and that is somebody who American audiences will be more familiar with, and that's Andrew Jackson. The very last interview I did in New Books in American Studies was with Mark Cheatham, who just published a biography entitled Andrew Jackson, Southerner. What did you learn about Andrew Jackson as a person, as a man, as a counterpoint to Edward Nichols in this book?
Well, I think it's the relationship between Nichols and Jackson is utterly fascinating. And everything I said about Nichols earlier, you can say pretty much the identical thing about Jackson, except for where he ends up. And what I mean by that is I think people underestimate the significance of Jackson's Irish origins. Jackson was born to Northern Irish parents. He grew up in the backcountry of South Carolina in a Northern Irish community. And I think a lot of the impulses that Nichols had, the maybe feeling a little bit insecure about his ethnic identity in a fundamentally Anglo entity, were also there for Jackson. And I think in a lot of ways, this explains Jackson's immense energy, Jackson's total embrace of violence, and Jackson's extreme willingness to protect what he saw as the racial order. And in a lot of ways, these two guys, I think, are kind of compensating, again, for their insecurities. And Nichols's way of compensating is to conceptualize the British Empire as liberal, universalist, anti-racist. Jackson's way to compensate is to conceptualize the American Empire as white, slave-driven, and essentially fundamentally, I don't know if racist is the right word, but racial order is essential to this. And both guys throw all of their energy and all of their passions into these things, largely because, again, they have this insecurity. They revile each other, and they write letters about each other, and they come very close to fighting each other, and both hope for the death of the other over and over again in the most explicit terms. But what neither seems to get is that they are two sides of one coin. And they could easily end up being the same person. If Jackson was born in Coleraine and Nichols was born in South Carolina, I suspect that Nichols would have been the president in the 1820s, and that Jackson would have been the man who drove the Americans nuts in the Southeast.
as you discussed in your book, and you just mentioned this right now, Jackson was not merely committed to protecting and extending slavery. He was dedicated to protecting and extended what you call a racial order. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that term?
I think that in the early Republic, especially in this period, in the era of the War of 1812 and the era of the Patriot War and the era of the Creek War, which are 1812 through 1814 respectively, the southern frontier is a fantastically violent place, and it's a place that makes Washington nervous, and it's a place which creates questions about loyalty, about all these different things. And I think the single biggest fear that white southerners have during this period is slave rebellion, especially after Haiti. And I think you need to look at this fear of slave rebellion and then Indian War, number two, as national security issues. And these are pressing issues that face the expansion of the United States, but imperil American citizens. Jackson sees the Red Stick War, the Red Sticks. Jackson sees Spanish Florida and their lack of control over the black and indigenous population. Jackson sees Nichols and all these different things as things which can lead to slave rebellion, as things which will lead to Indian uprising. And in Jackson's mind, that equals a restive frontier, that equals white American casualties, that equals an inability to expand the plantation complex, and that equals, again, a national security threat, which must be stopped. And you see this very clearly in Jackson's repeated illegal invasions of Spanish Florida, where he makes no pretenses of having sanction from Washington. He makes no pretenses of having international law on his side. But what he says is, I'm more than justified morally and ethically, because in these cases, there is this grave threat to essentially white America. And that's, I think, central to how white Southerners in particular saw the world during this period.
Okay, good. Well, that's a good segue, I think, to what we really need to talk about, which is the Maroons, which is really what this book is about, not about Edward Nichols and not about Andrew Jackson. So you just described the way in which Andrew Jackson kind of saw the world in these racial terms. Who are these Maroons, and how do they see the world? What are the influences that go into the way that they conceptualize this Atlantic world?
Well, they're a fascinating group of people. And one of the things, I feel like I've looked at every primary source, including archaeology that I could find. And, you know, you're never going to be fully satisfied that you're able to recreate life, but I think I did the best job possible. And what emerges is a picture of hundreds of people. I guesstimate that the average size after the British left in May of 1815, between July of 1816, so for over a year, was probably around 400 people, which is a very large Maroon community.
Mm-hmm.
The sex ratio was probably about 4-1 male to female, which sounds really imbalanced unless you remember that most other Maroons were 90 to 95 to 100% male. So it's a relatively healthy demographic. Maybe 10 to 15% of the population were under 15 years old. The oldest person I could find was 55. So you have a pretty healthy demographic breakdown. And interestingly is where these people came from. And they came from pretty much almost every major slave society, in the Atlantic world. And by that, I mean there were a lot of American slaves from the United mm-hmm. States. There were a lot of slaves from Spanish East and West Florida. These people would have oftentimes had their origins in other parts of the Spanish Atlantic world, places like Cuba, Puerto Rico. A lot of them also would have had their origins in the British Atlantic world, since a lot of slave owners in East and West Florida were British, so Jamaica and Barbados. One of the leaders was noted as being French, so either Louisiana or Haiti.
Right.
A large percentage had been Creek slaves. The Creeks were very large slave owners
mm-hmm.
by this point.
Mm-hmm.
Many have been living with the Seminole Indians. Many have been living in autonomous Maroon communities themselves for quite some time. One guy even miraculously made it there from Virginia on a British naval ship.
That's a hike.
Yeah, and remarkably, a lot of free slaves from St. Augustine, free people of color, rather, from St. Augustine joined the community. And, of course, you have maybe 5 to 10% directly from Africa. So you have people speaking Spanish and French and different African religions and different Indian languages and English. You have people who labored in cities. You have people who labored in cotton plantations, people who worked in the Lowcountry rice farms, people who have been living with the Indians for generations. So you get a remarkable cross-section of North American slaves and people of color.
Maybe you just answered this question, but I will ask you to confirm it. And I wanted to know how many of these people, to your knowledge, were African-born. You just suggested maybe it was 5 to 10%, or maybe was it higher than that, or do we really have much of an idea? Because, of course, the language that somebody speaks is not necessarily indicative of where they're from. The French-speaking slave you mentioned, for example, might well have been African-born.
He could have been. I wouldn't have thought any higher than 10%, and
okay. That
is based on where slaves would be coming from in these different societies, the handful of hard evidence I got, and names. As well, Congo Tom and people like that who appear there, in all probability, African. I think the day-to-day language would have been English. The majority of people there would have spoken English, which leads me to the answer to the second part of your question, how they saw the world. They were driven absolutely by their belief that they had been made British subjects. And
mm-hmm.
what happens is that while Nichols is there with them for the better part of 6 months or a year, he, one, explains his radical anti-slavery ideology to them. And then before he leaves, he gives all of them pieces of paper which make them full British subjects. And because he has explained his understanding of the British Empire, his radical anti-slavery message, and then very succinctly and clearly explained what goes into being a British subject, the Maroon community, and this is really without precedent, saw themselves as a polity, an enclave, with
mm-hmm.
the government of British subjects. And remarkably, I tracked down evidence from 30 years later, 50 years later, in Cuba and the Bahamas, respectively, where the people continue to stick to this idea that they are full British subjects, not an abstraction, not kind of, not that they have a relationship with the British, that they are British. And
mm-hmm.
this is remarkable. They have an incredible political consciousness.
How do you think they were able to acquire that consciousness? It just strikes me that, I'm doing some work right now on British and American missionaries in Africa, and these Anglo-Americans had the most difficult time communicating the most basic concepts of Protestant Christianity and Western civilization to African peoples, because those concepts were just completely alien to the environment and to the tribal background of peoples. Just such a cognitive leap. How do you think these Africans were able to understand and grasp the concepts of British Empire and British liberties that Nichols communicated to them?
I think a number of different ways. And one is what they brought with them. And here's where it's important that I think the majority of them are Creole. That is people born in the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And they would have brought, I think, their own understandings of what it means to be a slave, what it means to be free, what it means to be a political subject. These ideas may have been fairly abstract, but I think because of the time and place they were living in, they were acutely aware that these ideas were contested. And then,
right.
Like Haiti, the American Revolution, people of color had tried to claim these, sometimes had claimed these, sometimes had been denied. And I think they were aware this was a fundamental time of transformation, and that being a subject was good. Being a citizen was good. Having to serve in a militia was good, and that made you relatively free. So they brought their own ideas. I think that over this period of time when Nichols was there, he sat down and explained in no uncertain terms. And I think he, from what I can figure, had a very, charismatic way about him. I think that he didn't pull his punches. I mean, some of the rhetoric and language in the speeches is, you know, it's about dying and spilling your British blood to save these people
right.
of African descent who are all sons of King George. I think that he would have sat down with people who already had a foundation of these ideas and, again, instilled his extreme anti-racist message. He would have armed them, trained them, and then when it came time to leave, he would have, again, taken it that one step further and explained to them that you are now British subjects, and as I've been telling you for the last year, that means that you have legal rights, you have property rights, you have the right to serve in a militia, you have the right to protect your family, you have all of these different things. And I think that would have brought these abstract ideas that most of these people would have had into full clarity, because I think Nichols would have driven home fiercely the fact that this is the surest route to the most intense version of freedom. And being a British subject in the age of revolution was about as free as you could be,
mm-hmm.
other than being an American citizen.
Right.
And you know, these people were aware they weren't going to become American citizens anytime soon.
Right.
And this is important. And this is also an interesting idea, I think, in that lots of Maroons in places like Jamaica acquire British status with their treaties, but it was usually as subjects, it was usually as kind of peripheral people who had limited rights, and it was parent-child metaphors, and they didn't define themselves as British.
Mm-hmm.
They attached themselves to the king and the more conservative ideas of Britishness. So, but in the case of Prospect Bluff, these are people who are latching on to the most progressive ideas of the British state and the British Empire and ideas about parliament and representation and rights. And they're not really monarchists. They're not really royalist. They're much more in line with the, again, the more kind of liberal contours of British identity.
It seems to me that there was an existential threat hanging over this community. You mentioned that the United States, views communities like Prospect Bluff as existential threats, but there's a bit of a David and Goliath sort of image here. What really does the United States have to fear from this community? But this community had a lot to fear from the United States. To what extent were they a militarized community, you know, ready to defend themselves at the drop of a hat?
It was an extremely militarized community. And first of all, Prospect Bluff, where the community is located, was very carefully chosen by the British in May of 1814 as a spot to recruit Native Americans and African Americans. And it's a very commanding bluff over the Apalachicola River, which at this time was one of the most important waterways in the southeast. The British built a gigantic, highly defended fort, and they left the community armed to the teeth, 3,000 rifles, almost limitless amounts of powder and shot. And the community then is trained in by the British, and they continue to drill in their British uniforms on a daily basis, and they are a formidable military antagonist. The first attack on the community comes just a few weeks after the British leave, and very informatively, it's not by the Americans, it's by the Creek Indians. And the Creeks are slave owners, and there is a large percentage of the Creeks who are allied to the United States are developing a more modern racial consciousness in which they too are deeply scared of a racial disorder and view the community as a threat to their slaveholding interest, their national security. And the community repels this initial invasion, but the community is an immense military power, and it's also an immense economic power, which remarkably, by the spring of 1816, is actually undermining the economy of Spanish West Florida, including Pensacola, basically the one Spanish settlement, and in particular, it's diverting Indian trade away from West Florida to the point where the governor of Spanish West Florida is saying, look, we can't compete economically with this community. Not only is it a brutal military antagonist, but it's draining the colony of life.
How well informed were Americans about what you call the Negro Fort, or what they called the Negro Fort?
Very well, very well. And word zips around this world very, very quickly, and especially when it's about something like 500 heavily armed slaves right on the door of the plantation complex. But the American press, every other week there's a major article on it. A lot of the information is incorrect or suspicious.
Right.
A lot of it's a little bit overwrought. But people are aware. Washington is aware. And in the South, people are acutely and intensely aware. And probably most importantly, Andrew Jackson's aware. The governor of Georgia is aware. The governor of Louisiana is aware. And Americans are utterly committed to the destruction of this community because it embodies not just the threat to racial disorder, but because it also is one of the last vestiges of foreign interference. And they see very much the fact that they think at least that the British are pulling the strings and that foreign intervention is as much a threat as anything else. So it's kind of the sum of all fears, I suppose, in the white Southern imagination.
Right. You mentioned the gender ratio of Prospect Bluff being approximately 4-1. And that kind of leads me to a question about how they manage their day-to-day affairs. Did that gender ratio lead to any tension within the community? You know, how did they administer themselves, you know, feed themselves, you know, run their political affairs and so forth?
In terms of tensions, nothing that I could pick up on the record. What I did pick up on is that families seem to flourish at Prospect Bluff. I got the impression that any number of families lived together. There was remarkably, from what I can figure, a school where children were educated, which is totally unheard of in the history of marinage. The lack of women in many Maroon communities was probably the single greatest source of internal threat other than ethnic differences. And
right.
Maroons went to great lengths to try to avoid this, try to avoid these issues, but very frequently they couldn't. And struggles over women and issues like that and raiding for women got many Maroons into a tremendous degree of trouble. I don't get the impression that was the case at Prospect Bluff because, like I said, 4-1 is a relatively balanced sex ratio. In terms of daily life, they seemed to have cultivated fields. It was flourishing in terms of how they were feeding themselves. They seemed to spend a lot of time, the men, hunting, so they had a regular supply of meat. The archaeological records suggest that they weren't hungry. They're not eating frogs, they're not eating raccoons and things like that. They seemed to be well supplied with a good diet. They also seemed to have been wise and held on to the materials that the British had left them.
Right.
When the fort is destroyed in July of 1816, there's tons of evidence of pots and pans and shovels and wheelbarrows and boats. And these things would have been the absolute envy of other Maroon communities who simply had to make do with what they had in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
The community of Prospect Bluff is, you cannot argue, is far and away the materially wealthiest Maroon community and the most advantageously situated when it comes to material culture. And it's largely because, it is totally because of its relationship with the British. But the people there understood this advantage and then cultivated it. And as I said before, they really construct a flourishing, what I think is an exchange economy, where they trade with largely the Seminole Indians. Mm-hmm. They seem to have an attachment to private property. They seem to be very committed to having this economy flourish. And what they're doing, from what I can figure and argue, is they have constructed a British polity, and they have an understanding of what subjects do in their polity, and they get along with their lives, and they own their homes, and they cultivate their fields, and they have rights, and they exchange these goods, and that's what's going on at Prospect Bluff.
How do they, politically, how do they make decisions? Is it a council?
They have
form of government? Go ahead.
They have three men who are identified as the leaders, three very interesting men who are kind of ideally suited for the job. They're all originally from Pensacola. However, like I said before, one is described as being French. One, I mm-hmm. think, is probably African based on his name. His name is Prince. And one is mm-hmm. literate. And not only is he literate, but he was also the skilled slave of the man who had briefly been the mayor of Pensacola. Very privileged and had a very insightful view of politics during this era. They're all skilled, and they all seem to have spent a tremendous amount of time with Nichols. When Nichols leaves, he right. commissions them as officers. They have an array of supporting officers underneath them. And from what I can figure, there were sheriffs, and they had a body of law and order, and they had a sense of the physical boundaries of their property as well. So it was a coherent government with a great big Union Jack, which flew above the fort every day, in which they identified themselves as leading a British polity, not maybe right. ruling as dictators, but leading a British polity.
Well, maybe that Union Jack, which is, you know, figuratively one great big middle finger pointed right to Georgia, wasn't such a great idea. Because, as you point out, despite the advantages, the geographical advantages, the material advantages of Prospect Bluff, it is reduced by the United States. Can you just give a quick rundown about what happens to the fort?
It is, and you have to think that it was never going to be particularly long-lived, mm-hmm. because America emerged so confident from the War of 1812. Britain was in the process of cutting its losses in the Southeast in particular, and the Spanish had almost no control over Florida.
Right.
What happens is that in the spring and summer of 1816, the forces in play really get going. And in particular, Edmund Gaines is commissioned by Andrew Jackson to oversee an extended movement against it. He works in concert with the Creek Indians, who, again, very much want his destruction. And they are surprisingly, the Americans, surprisingly diplomatic with the Spanish. And what the Spanish say, Spanish West Florida governor, is that we have no love lost for these people. They're giving us a headache. We certainly can't do anything about it. Let's mm-hmm. and hear from Cuba what they say, our superiors down there. But at the same time, Gaines gets permission from the governor of West Florida to be on the Apalachicola River, and if the American forces are fired upon, that they can then in turn retaliate. So what happens is Gaines cooks up this elaborate flotilla up from New Orleans, which is going to meet with an army brigade and hundreds of Creek Indians. And what he's assuming correctly is that the fort will fire on the Native.
Mm-hmm.
And they do. And what happens is Gaines then feels free to begin a raid on the fort behind the claim of self-defense. So mm-hmm. very much an 1816 kind of Gulf of Tonkin resolution. 1816, the community fires on the Navy, and what ensues in the very last week of July of 1816 is a fierce battle. Rather unfortunately for the community, a large percentage of the military-age men were away on an extended hunting trip. But the leaders who are there, and it's primarily Garçon, the French former slave, are able to get mm-hmm. the vast majority of the inhabitants out. And in particular, they kind of slip out the back where there's a swamp, and they go and join the Seminoles. And in the end of 1816, there's this freakish incident where the fort is incinerated when the powder magazine lights on fire.
Right.
But prior to this point, the very underhanded community was giving the Americans and the Creeks everything they could handle, and they were winning the battle. They had no intention of surrendering. They had no reason to believe they were going to lose anytime soon, and if it wasn't for this freakish shot, who knows how much longer they could have held out. But nonetheless, the fort is incinerated, but the vast majority of people have since retreated and regrouped with the Seminole Indians.
Yeah. Of course, at the end of your book, you talk about, you know, how these people do escape, and they get wrapped up or caught up in the another war that Americans probably don't know very much about, which is the First Seminole War. What happens during the war, and what role do the Maroons play?
Well, I think that the Maroons are absolutely central to the First Seminole War, and they are, I argue, the driving force in the First Seminole War. One, their animosity towards the United States, and two, the American desire to wipe out the last vestiges of this Maroon community. What happens is these folks largely regroup living with the Seminoles. They are utterly committed to their British status. They feel as if their rights have been violated. They feel as if their allies have been murdered, and they are as committed to Nichols's message as ever before. At the same time, there are a handful of British proxies who correspond with Nichols, who appear and make a series of promises about the reappearance of Nichols and recommit them to these ideas. So they, in conjunction with the Seminoles, who are increasingly radicalized as American encroachments become more aggressive and as they absorb a lot of their red stick cousins, are deeply anti-American. And Americans are really pushing the boundaries of American expansion. And at the same time, amongst the American military, there is an absolute desire to round up and destroy the remnants of this community because it had been so offensive to American racial sensibilities and because it had been such a grave threat to American national security. And I found some of the most remarkable evidence that the British allies are saying to the Seminoles, look, they're just after the people from Prospect Bluff. an independent Maroon is saying that, look, they're just after the people from Prospect Bluff. Edmund Gaines is saying, look, we're just after the people from Prospect Bluff.
Wow.
If you give us these people, we will go away. and they don't. And they become these formidable antagonists. And the war spans 1817 to 1818. It ends when the Americans once again invade Pensacola. But again, the vast majority of people from Prospect Bluff are still alive, and they've regrouped once again at a large Maroon community near modern-day Tampa called Angola. Jackson wants to finish them off right there, but the president says, no, look, we're in negotiations with the Spanish, so just enough. Come back. 1821, when Jackson is the military governor of American Florida, the very first thing he does is send the Creek Indians to destroy this community. They kill a lot of the people who originated at Prospect Bluff. They re-enslave a lot, but many fled once again, and they this time end up in the Bahamas, where I think the most hopeful stream ends up. And remarkably, they live for 10 years on an outer island with the British completely unaware they're there, and they live in a town they call Nicholstown. And they are
that
totally...
says a lot.
Yeah, it's incredible. And when the British find them, they share their free papers, they explain what happened with Nichols, and the British say, okay, we're convinced you're British subjects.
That's really fascinating. So how do you follow this up? What's going to be next for you?
Kind of the opposite of a micro history, I suppose a macro history of Afro-Indian relations in the entire British Atlantic world from 1550 to 1815. So in some ways, similar questions about race and identity and the contours of the British Atlantic world, but really trying to understand how these relations, which I think are powerfully understudied in this region, impacted everyday life, policy, the formation of culture, and all of these different things. So I suppose a real reexamination of the British Atlantic world from a Black and Indian perspective.
Well, that is that's a large study, very big. So we'll talk to you then when you finish that. It should be no problem.
Yeah, a couple of years probably.
Well, Nathaniel Millett, thank you so much for joining us at New Books in American Studies.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You bet. So once again, this is Dan Kilbride from New Books in American Studies. We've been talking with Nathaniel Millett about his new book, The Maroons of Prospect Bluff and Their Quest for Freedom in the Atlantic World. Take care, and we'll see you next time.